RN's White Paper, a free monthly digital magazine. Subscribe at our homepage.
Hi there, Edwina Farley with you for A Country Breakfast on RN. Do we have a lip-smacking treat in store for you?
Well, we're going to start with alpaca brain ravioli, served with a quinoa broth, braised shiitake mushrooms, and some baby rocket on top. Then the next course is an alpaca neck terrine with cherries, sour cherries.
It's the alpaca from head to tail and like you've never experienced later in the program. But Tony Allen joins us first with the week in rural news. And Tony, quite a bit of extra money for drought-affected farmers this week.
Yes, the federal government has found an extra $100 million to give or to offer to drought-affected farmers in New South Wales and Queensland, where the drought is still biting the hardest. It had previously offered drought assistance at a rate of about 4% over 5 years for concessional loans for farmers. But now they've found some more money from funding that wasn't allocated in the farm finance package that Labor set up. The Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce, says this is a better deal. Farmers will be able to apply for loans of up to $1 million over 10 years at an initial interest rate of just 3.2%.
When we came to government, there was no drought policy. We had apparently a miraculous event in the previous government where they said the droughts were over and it was all fixed. We had to construct from the bottom up drought policy. And we are doing that and you're seeing that.
Well, it's interesting that he should say that because the National Farmers Federation this week released its own suggested drought relief policy, which, among other things, calls for less paperwork for farmers, no cuts to rural counselling, more money for water infrastructure and pest control, and it says loan periods for drought money should be increased to 15 years and interest rates should be as low as 2.5%. Now, interestingly, Brent Finlay says the NFF is working towards a long-term drought policy, as is the government, but it's proving a bit difficult.
We're trying to have that discussion, and I know there are certain members in the parliament that are. Again, it's a unique political climate at the moment. There are so many things that are in play, and drought keeps getting pushed to the side.
There's also a shortage of organic grain caused once again by the drought. Now, organic grain production had been affected already by some of the big corporate growers pulling out of organics, but the dry conditions are expected to cut this year's crops. And it's not just for people who eat organic grain that it's a problem. Andrew Monk from Australian Organic Limited says the problem is really feed grain for organic livestock, including chicken, eggs, pork and dairy.
Some producers have said to us, look, we've probably got the next year's contract sorted out. We are definitely concerned beyond that at the moment. Some of them are saying, I can't now confidently grow my business any further than what I currently have without further surety, and that's not good for an industry within a broader marketplace that's growing quite significantly.
And it's not the only industry struggling with supply. Honey is also in a bad way.
Yes, so we have mentioned before that there's a national honey shortage because of dry conditions on the Australian mainland. Our volumes across Australia fell by half this year to 13,000 tonnes of honey. And Tasmania, which is a big honey producer, has been trying to meet some of the demand, but Tasmanian beekeepers have already sold out of their gourmet product, leatherwood honey, so much so that they've stopped exporting it to everywhere except the United States to make sure there's enough leatherwood honey for Tasmania. It's quite a rare thing, the leatherwood honey, only produced in certain areas, including Mole Creek in northern Tasmania. And beekeeper Shirley Stevens there says she's never seen a season as desperate as this.
We are out of honey, never been out of leatherwood before that I can remember, but the orders have been fantastic. A wonderful situation to be in, but I'd rather be able to supply them. We could see it coming in June, so we stopped all export orders except for the United States. Honey we had left has been kept for the local trade.
Now, we've touched on for some time the idea from Liberal Senator Chris Back that there would be an animal welfare bill addressing various issues nationally regarding animal welfare, which is usually something left up to the states. What did we find out this week?
Well, Senator Back from Western Australia is going to introduce a bill next year, early next year, that will require anyone with footage of animal cruelty to hand it to authorities within 5 days. He argues that if you do uncover a breach of animal welfare, it's in the animal's best interest to highlight it immediately rather than hold on to the footage. And he's accusing animal rights groups of keeping footage to release at convenient moments to the media for political reasons, not for animal welfare reasons. His bill will also include, as yet undisclosed, criminal penalties for anyone who trespasses on farms, damages property, or causes harm to animals, people, or trade. Now, there's a fair chance this bill is going to get passed because Labor agrees with it in principle at least, but it wants to see the detail of the bill before deciding whether to support it. But the Greens won't be supporting it. Greens spokesperson on animal welfare, Senator Lee Rhiannon, says it's an attempt to gag animal activists.
By far the majority of farmers do the right thing. They love and they care for their animals. But there still is a role for undercover investigators to expose animal cruelty. And that's what Senator Back is attempting to shut down.
And the RSPCA is also against the bill, saying that if they really cared about animal welfare, Senator Back would have consulted the RSPCA in drawing it up. But quite a few farmers, including Peter Bradford, who's a free-range pork producer from Western Australia, support the legislation, and he says that cruelty should be exposed immediately.
There's not much point allegedly gathering a lot of bad treatment, inhumane treatment on animals, and then sitting on it for 6-12 months down the track or outside the statute of limitations when there's no recourse. If somebody's doing something cruel to animals, deal with it straight away.
An interesting development in the northern prawn industry relating, I suppose, really to climate change.
Yes, if you looked at the boat owned by Tropic Ocean Prawns, you probably wouldn't notice anything different, but it's actually quite a revolutionary thing. This trawler is being funded by the Australian Seafood Cooperative Research Centre with a new refrigeration system that will use better and less expensive gases for refrigeration. Now, in 2016, the R22 gas, which currently powers these refrigeration system, is being phased out. So they've got to find something new that won't deplete the ozone layer. And Michael O'Brien from Tropic Ocean Prawn says if the trial on his boat works, it's going to be a win not just for the fishermen financially, but for the environment too.
The gases that they're phasing out, we've paid up to $160 a kilo for them. The newer gas that we're putting in goes for about $35 a kilo. So there's a massive saving just on gas alone. So, yeah, they're our benchmarks, is to a system that doesn't leak and a system that freezes as well or better than what we had in there.
And it's a bird, it's a plane. No, it's trout cam.
Yes, it can take hours to drive up to the lakes of Tasmania, of the Tasmanian plateau, to catch a fish. There's an easy way to find out what's biting because you can just look on the internet. Tasmania's trout cam is proving a huge success. Anglers Alliance Tasmania set up 9 webcams in the state's lakes and creeks so anglers could go on the net and get a 24-hour picture of conditions at their favourite fishing spots. Apparently it's been huge and it's led to a lot more people wanting to fish and inquiring about trout fishing in Tasmania. Operator of Trout Territory Fishing Tours, Gary France, says he's heard of interest from all over the world.
It's astounding how many people are actually looking at these cameras per month, thousands. And it's not just Tasmania. They're looking at the situations from Melbourne, where they come from, visitors, etc. So it's valuable for visitors. It's valuable for tourism. It's valuable for safety. And it's valuable for information when you want to go out and plan a day.
And it's much easier to look at a trout on the internet than to actually catch one.
Yes, it reminds me of the sort of tendency to go, gee, I wonder how heavily it's going to rain when it's raining outside, and online you go to the radar. Amazing. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
You can find all of those stories, of course, online at abc.net.au/rural.
RN's White Paper has distilled our rich content into a digital magazine of ideas, drawing on multimedia archives and the expertise of RN's journalists. White Paper spanned themes from libertarianism to war, literature, economics, mental health and gender. This month, we explore the idea of leadership in contemporary Australia. People at the top of their game in politics, media, arts, religion and science. We hope you enjoy it. White Paper is on the RN homepage.
I'm Edwina Farley. You're with A Country Breakfast on RN. Our rural reporters have been pretty busy this week. Let's find out where they've been travelling. This week, a former chef turns her hand to cooking up beauty creams and ointments. The New England region showcases its local produce, and we get our hands on some famous marble bar jasper. We'll also join a farm tour in tropical North Queensland that's helping bridge the city-country divide.
There aren't a lot of opportunities for kids to get onto farms and to see how what happens on farms. And so I guess that's why the response has been really, really good. We didn't really go out and advertise. It's just been word of mouth and the Facebook page, which kind of, you know, it leads its own life. It's like this little monster that creates so much interest in what we're doing that the word has spread without any effort on our part.
Freckle Farm tours coming up, but first today, a visit to another organic farm in southern New South Wales that's producing a range of lotions and potions.
It's an old thing to do, making creams and ointments out of herbs. So you still are restricted by recipes, but oh, there's so much scope to play around and get new things out, and I love it.
It seems like Kay Saarinen was always destined to make her own range of cosmetic creams and lotions. Her botanist father instilled in her a love of plants and flowers, and with 13 years' experience as a chef, she's been only too happy to experiment with tinctures and infusions in the kitchen.
With my food background, a lot of it came very, very easy to me. I understood food science, which you can apply that very easily to cream making, and because it's all about emulsifying, and there's you know, chemical reactions that you have to take into play.
Hello, I'm Michael Kavanagh. Kay has thousands of herbs and flowering plants, even some medicinal weeds like stinging nettles, growing on her organic farm near the small town of Wyndham on the far south coast of New South Wales. And she uses them all to make her distinctive organic beauty products.
And so I just started dabbling and really, really quite enjoyed it. Learned how to do tinctures, herbal infusions, extractions. Did a little bit of aromatherapy as well to understand essential oils. And so I got the basic ointments and the basic cream base that you've got to start. It's just like making a mayonnaise. It doesn't matter where you come from, a mayonnaise is egg and oil and vinegar, and you can't, you know, really differ from that. Maybe a bit of lemon juice. So that's the same as a cream base. And then from there, you can add on. I've had to do a lot of experimenting and had a lot of fails and a couple of explosions.
Now, standing in your farm here, there's things that I can easily identify. Yeah. Lemon trees, now you don't use that. There's kale, the vegetable, you don't use that. Of the herbs, though, there's rosemary. Now, I do know what rosemary is.
Good.
But there's also, and it's your favourite, explain to me just here, it's a flower between bright yellow and orange, almost pumpkin-like in colour.
Absolutely. Fluorescent orange, I would say. Go the 60s fluoro. I love it. It's my absolute favourite herb, Calendula officinalis, and is the correct one. There are quite a lot of common ones like the marigold, which is, you know, you can't use. This calendula you can eat it too. They used to use it as food colouring as well. But the antibacterial, antifungal, they soothe. It's great for rashes. It's great for thrushes, heat rash, burns. I put it in anything I possibly can. In fact, my little girl, this is how it all started too. When I was doing my course, my herb culture course, and my little girl had eczema down her neck. And I thought, oh, I'm growing this beautiful calendula, starting to get into it and work out what's going on, how it all works. And I made calendula ointment with it, and using a very, very old traditional recipe, and sourcing really good beeswax. Like, every other ingredient has to be as good as the herbs that I'm growing. Made up my first batch of calendula ointment and popped it on her, and it worked.
So your daughter was the guinea pig.
She was the guinea pig, the poor darling. I don't test on animals, just friends and rallies.
Once you've got the herbs growing and they're ready to pick, and you're going to then make up some of your products, how do you go about doing it?
Every herb has got their specific way that they've got to be harvested. And Ultraback Cleanse Liquid is my favourite. You can't pick it too early in the morning with the dew on it, because the water on it will basically take away the strength of the flower. So at about 10 o'clock, once the dew's come off, so around about 10 o'clock is a perfect time, so the sun hasn't got out and dried them up, because the flowers don't last very long. They only last a couple of days at their absolute best. So once they open, so you've only got about 2 days of picking them. I use a lot of root herbs as well, which is comfrey. So I've got to wait until they go dormant. So that's a winter. So that's just a winter herb. So that's when I have to get out there, dig it all up and wash it all up, and then I process it into my tinctures, enough for a year. And I even actually go down to the creek, and that's where I get my stinging nettle. I use stinging nettle in my face cream. Got to suit up for that. Got to have gloves, got to have a shovel, and gum boots. And yes, I have been stung quite a few times. So that all grows wild in our creek, so I won't harvest that.
You sell your product through the various markets around the area. What sort of reaction do you get from people when they wander up and see how they're made and what they're for?
Once I explain that we grow all our own fresh herbs and make everything from scratch, it's always comes with a, oh, really? It's really quite an unusual thing to do. I didn't think it was until I got out there. I love the reaction that people are interested. They want to know where their skincare is coming from, just like their food. They want to know where it's grown. They want to know how it's processed. And the fact that they're talking to me and they're buying from me, I'm growing it, I'm harvesting it, and I'm manufacturing it, and now I'm standing there and I'm selling it as well, that it's a fantastic thing, doing markets.
And by the looks of things, the customers are pleased she's here too. There's a steady queue of them lining up at the monthly Candelo market wanting to buy her lotions and potions.
I accidentally sort of ran into it at the Candelo markets a few, probably around Christmas time, and I've been using the day cream pretty much ever since, and my daughter drinks the wellness tea.
What makes the cream different to some of the others that you'd say buy through a normal retailer?
I just like that I know that what's in it. It's all natural and it's made locally.
Well, I like the feel of them on my skin. They're beautiful to wear, and I just really abhor the idea of animal testing. I love that she makes them.
Is there anything in particular that you tend to come and purchase regularly?
The face cream, and she makes a great hand cream. The hand cream really works.
The red jasper comes from Marble Bar. There's also the Pilbara jade. Jade we get around here can be almost black, and that's quite popular. We pride ourselves on having stones from within the Pilbara. There are odd ones you bring in, like lapis from Afghanistan and Turkey, but we prefer to stay within the Pilbara.
And why wouldn't you concentrate on these beautiful local gems when you live in such a rich mining region? G'day, I'm Lucy Bell, and today I've found myself inside a small mining museum in the West Australian town of Marble Bar, which is in the Pilbara region in the state's northwest. This area is best known for attracting gold prospectors, but there's another draw card here too. It's not marble, as you might expect, but the distinctive rich red jasper stone that's found in the striking rock formation after which this town is named. Early miners mistook the jasper for marble, so really the town should be known as Jasper Bar, not Marble Bar. This is just one of the interesting little historical gems that I've picked up since meeting museum manager Trevor Corrigal. What have we got here in front of us, Trevor? Okay. What are some of the ones we've got?
It's polished iron ore, hematite. It's a shiny silver grey. Makes beautiful necklaces, almost like black pearls. That's tiger eye. It has a beautiful honey colour through it. And you get tiger iron, which is a darker one, has a lot more iron ore through it.
And is that from around these parts?
Yes, around Marble Bar, Tom Price, and also out at Yarri. And the amethyst can be found down around Nullagine.
It looks like you've got some real rich purples there alongside some paler lilacs. Mm,
there is. It's quite a difference. Some people prefer the darker ones. Some people prefer the softer lilac sort of colour. Then there's the mucaite jasper.
Mucaite jasper.
It comes from Mooka Station, which is east of Carnarvon.
Would we call that a bit of a mustard yellow to it, maybe?
It has. It has quite a few colours, from purple through to mustard yellow to a reddish type of colour at some stage. We don't have any of that at the moment, unfortunately.
So that one's from around the Gascoyne?
It is.
A little further along here, what have we got?
We've got citrine, which is almost like a barley sugar colour, and the red jasper is what the Marble Bar is famous for.
And let's have a little closer look at the red jasper. If you were to try and describe that red for me, how would you do it, Trevor?
You'd probably best describe it as a matte Pilbara red, the typical red dirt of the Pilbara, but it's a little duller in colour.
And is that the kind of rock that we see in the bar here at Marble Bar?
Yes, it is. The Marble Bar itself, you can't take it from there, but just back on the road up here, there's a pit where you can go up the cliff and take it off and help yourselves. But it turns into all sorts of things. It makes beautiful jewellery.
And so all of these samples of some of the rocks from around here are here at the Comet Mine Museum. And right outside the museum, we can see the mine after which this place is named. And it's fairly spectacular. How long has the Comet Mine been closed for now?
They stopped taking gold out in 1955. It became unviable. And they processed tin, tantalite and copper up until the late 90s, I believe. And then it was closed down altogether. So now it's in caretaker mode. There's still lots of ore in the mine. There's still gold in the ore, but it's a matter of extracting it. It's a very fine gold called sulphide gold. It's like talcum powder.
The most striking feature about the Comet Mine for somebody that's never seen it, as you approach these red, distinct Marble Bar hills, is the tall chimney standing in the middle. What would that have been used for?
That was mainly to get the sulphide fumes and everything out of the valley. So they used to use sulfuric acid, hydrochloric acid, and once the ore was baked, all the fumes had come off, so they had to get it out of the valley in case it poisoned people. It was the tallest in the southern hemisphere at one stage, at 75 metres, and that was the only Oc Health commitment that they had back in the 30s, 40s and 50s.
And is that the decades around which that mine would have really been buzzing?
It is. The gold was discovered in 1937. Between 1937 and 1955, they took 40 tonnes of gold out. So there's a fair bit of gold.
So Marble Bar does have a well-deserved reputation for its gold, but it is those other rocks that really caught my eye. Do people still come prospecting for those other rocks, or do they not fetch as pretty a price?
We get a lot of people from eastern states. Fossicking is very popular in the eastern states. So West Australians do it, but I don't think they do it to the same extent. But 90% of the queries we get here is from eastern staters.
And if you were a fossicker from the eastern states come all the way over here, what's the one rock they really want to add to their collection?
Marble Bar jasper, the red jasper. And the second one after that is the Marble Bar jade, so, which is a serpentine type rock. But there's so many different little pieces of rock in the creeks that people quite often pick them up. And just because it's different, it's a different colour or form, they enjoy it. They take it.
Trevor Corrigal, managing that gem museum in the Pilbara. Lucy Bell with the story on the famous Marble Bar jasper. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, a trip to Freckle Farm near Mackay in Queensland. And the New England region in New South Wales puts itself on the food map.
How you going, mate?
How you going?
Are you right there, doll?
It's all about, you know, short food miles, quality product, minimal processing, great food.
And there's plenty of that, great food that is, on show here today in Urella, a small town near Armidale in northern New South Wales. Hello, I'm Emma Brown and this is The Taste of the New England, a showcase of all the delicious things this diverse region has to offer. There's lamb and smoked trout, tasty sausages made with local beer, cakes and preserves, breads and pastries and even some ginger beer with just a touch of chilli. And that's just for starters. Tara Toomey is the energy and organiser behind the event.
There we go. Thank you very much. You have a good day.
People keep saying they love that this is a showcase of what you can find in the New England. It gives them a sample of what's here. They'll come back next time for a week and maybe go out to that winery or visit that restaurant or go to Nundle for the day because they've seen these lovely things. So what we're hoping is that that is what people think about when they come. But people have really focused on how different the range is here to other regions, and they appreciate that this really is a food bowl, but people maybe didn't realise that. There is so much produce here that they just didn't know was available in the region, and they're glad to see it here today.
Sure, the first or the second one you tried?
And lots of people are streaming through the gates, keen to see what's for sale. I'm getting pretty hungry and thirsty myself, so let's go join the queue and check out what's on offer in some of these stalls.
Steve and Viv, we're from Grumpy's Ginger Beer. We're based in Coffs Harbour.
Now, you're here in your stall. You've got all this lovely homemade ginger beer. How often do you go to events like this?
We focus on mainly major food events throughout regional Australia. So we do Taste Tamworth, Nosh on the Nemoy. This one here today, Urella, which is just a beautiful little place. Our product is very much of a a high-quality food, non-alcoholic drink. We use utilise local ginger, a little bit of chilli just to spice it up. We target that really high-quality local product.
So what goes into actually making homemade ginger beer?
Well, really good quality ingredients is important, good quality water. We don't use a yeast, so it's a yeast-free brew, and we utilise a small microbrewery, and we make 800 litres at a time.
So how much have you brought here today to sell?
We've bought one batch, so 2,500 bottles.
Wow, and how much have you sold already?
We're probably halfway through.
Oh, yes. So you're hoping to sell out before the end of the day?
We're known to sell out of our product at most events that we go to.
Faye Lullum, Pukeko Preserves from Kentucky.
And I'm Trish Rasmussen with the Lazy Magpie.
So ladies, you're here today in the same stall. What are you selling?
A mixture of jams and preserves and pickles and cordials and sauces and some shortbread and Christmas mini Christmas cakes. So, yeah, getting organised for Christmas as well.
Hey, you've got some fruit cordials here, which is probably something that people probably haven't seen a lot of natural fruit cordials before. What goes into making them?
It's just the fruit and sugar and a little bit of citric acid, which is a small preservative. But, yeah, that's all they are. They're all natural. So it's a matter of what excess I have of fruit that I have experimented with the different cordials.
Faye, have you been busy so far today?
Yes. Yeah, we've got a lot of comeback customers now. We've been doing this for about 3 years and we have our regular customers now. They know they've got a good product.
My name is Emma Tiki and my business name is Cakes by Emma Jane.
So Emma, you do have some beautiful cakes here in front of us today. How many hours of preparation did this take to getting this display up?
Quite a few, as you can imagine, quite a few late nights, just all the little bits and pieces.
Now you do have some big, obviously wedding and big birthday cakes here, but what have you actually got for sale for people to buy here?
I've got gluten-free Freons, I've got cupcakes, I've got homemade Rocky Road, white chocolate Rocky Road, I've got some choc cherry bars and some new favourites of the marshmallows. Yeah.
So you're making your own marshmallows?
I am, yeah. New experiment.
Dale Goodwin, Dale's Downtown Meats.
So Dale, you're the local butcher here in Yarralla. What have you brought for today's market?
Beer sausages.
Now where have you sourced that beer from?
The New England Brewing Company. It's a brewery in Yarralla, just up the top of the hill. Yeah, we work with them and we use their beer instead of the water. And all local beef, pork, yeah.
Have you been selling well today? Your stalls looked pretty busy all day.
I think we're about 1,600 were sold so far. There's a few trays left in the room and we brought 1,800 with us.
So what beers have you been using to make those sausages?
We use the main beers they have all the time, which is dark ale, pale ale and the golden ale. But when Ben brews a new one, we make a new sausage to go with that, yeah.
So what does that do to the flavour of the sausage as opposed to just mixing it up with water?
I suppose it adds this, different ones. Like the dark ales are more of a stronger flavour. The pale ale's sweet, so it does add flavour to that. And you just got to match the meat to the flavour of the beer. So, pork goes well with the pale one because it's a little bit sweeter. The dark ales are beef, caramelised onion, yeah. They're really nice. They're something you won't get anywhere else either.
If you wanted to have one of these and then drive, how many sausages can you have before you're over the limit?
I don't know. I think you'd have to have a fair few. Yeah.
What do you think about the market? Good?
Yeah, good.
Would you like a cherry
Do you think
bag?
This will put the New England on the map as a foodie region and help it to compete with, say, regions like the Central West that has, the Oranges Food Festival, for example?
Well, it's a pretty enviable reputation they've got. I'd love to think we could just make our mark and be recognised for the producers we have here who are pretty talented, who do some really good things working with the climate, the soil, the temperatures and the environments that we have to produce something that's just reflective of that and different, therefore, to what is in other regions. So, yeah, I hope we can make a stamp at it, yeah.
It's a beautiful day today, isn't it?
It's often said these days that city people are out of touch with farmers and where their food actually comes from. Well, I've found a farming family here in North Queensland who are doing their best to bridge that gap.
You can grab an egg and you can throw the egg in here and see what happens. Not at me! Okay, so this is a special special treat for a pig. They don't get eggs every day, but sometimes we get eggs that are too small to sell.
Hello, I'm Susanna Baker on Freckle Farm near the town of Eaton, southwest of Mackay. It's here that Deb McLucas and Rob Bowman run farm tours, introducing city kids and their parents too to their free-ranging pigs and chickens. It's all part of the family's vision to share their knowledge about sustainable farming.
Right from the earliest times when we considered setting up this venture was that we did want to be able to share what we are learning here and what we know about farming and food and producing food in the way that we do with other people, and that includes kids. And in fact, whenever you talk to other farmers about, I don't like the word educate, but trying to raise awareness about the importance of farmers and the food and the role that we play in the community, they often say that, you know, you've got to start with the kids and, you know, why aren't kids doing this in school? Well, this is our way of being able to expose kids to those sorts of opportunities.
How responsive are the kids? You have high school kids coming through as well. What's the feedback like?
There aren't a lot of opportunities for kids to get onto farms and to see what happens on farms. And so I guess that's why the response has been really, really good. We didn't really go out and advertise. It's just been word of mouth and the Facebook page, which kind of, you know, it leads its own life. It's like this little monster that creates so much interest in what we're doing that the word has spread without any effort on our part. So I know just from the responses that we're getting, and of course the involvement of the kids, that just the looks on their faces and the kinds of comments and the excitement, you've almost got to put a lid on it sometimes to stop them from racing into the pen with the pigs because they're so excited to see the things that they do when they're here.
I'm Trent and I'm 8 years old.
What was your favourite thing about today, Trent?
I'm going to see the pigs and throwing the eggs.
Did you learn anything new?
Yeah, how you can get white eggs.
So you learnt that a white chicken lays a white egg?
Yep, and a brown chicken lay the brown egg.
And Shakira, what about you? Did you learn anything new today?
How pigs help produce the soil in the ground and mulch it.
My name's Luke. I am 12 years old. I learnt about what kind of animals do what.
Why is it important to know about where your food comes from?
Because in case it's like if your chickens are caged eggs, they mightn't be produced properly and all that.
And you think that's important?
Yeah, highly.
We're talking about real food. What does that mean to you, real food?
I'd say it means that better to eat more of your fresh products and not your false, like, your junk food and all that.
All of these things we can produce, we can grow on this farm, and we use to eat for our family, and we also sell some of it to people in the local area as well. I call this real food.
When I sat down and thought, okay, you've got a bunch of kids here, you're really only going to have one message that's going to get through at the end of the day for them. I mean, they'll remember lots of things, but the thing that I really do focus on is helping them to understand the difference between, processed food and food that comes from farms, food that, you can see is not very much changed from its original form. So it's your meats, it's your vegetables, it's your, things that you grow in the garden. And that's the stuff kids can do too. And some of them are doing that and recognising how important it is to do that.
Great, I love strawberries. What about you, Ed? Corn, lovely. Okay, are the real foods that you're growing at home?
Radishes,
yeah, they're good because they grow really fast.
The tours have been so popular, Deb and Rob have had to turn some people away and increase the numbers of tours they run. It's a sign there's an appetite from city people to connect with their farming cousins and learn more about where their food comes from.
We just love to share what we're passionate about. And that's how we've learnt, is to go onto farms, and people have been so open and willing to share what they know about the things we've been interested in, that it's just, you get what you get back what you give out. And so the tours and just giving people a chance to come and learn a bit about farming, what happens on farms and how you do produce real food, it's just a natural flow on for us to be doing that.
Deb McLucas from Freckle Farm near Mackay, spreading a sustainable food message to children and adults through those popular farm tours. Susanna Baker there with the story. I'm Edwina Farley. This is A Country Breakfast on RN. Now, you might be planning your Christmas lunch or dinner at the moment, and you might be considering ham or seafood or turkey, but you also might want to consider something a little different, and we'll take a taste of that in a moment.
Are you a young scientist with passion and flair, wanting to make an impact? Well, to mark 40 years of The Science Show, RN and the University of New South Wales have launched Top 5 Under 40. It's a chance to turn your research into compelling radio and online features. Our Top 5 Under 40 winners will also join a Scientists in Residence program here at RN, giving a new generation of scientists a voice. Top 5 Under 40 is on the RN homepage.
Until now, Australia's alpaca industry has been predominantly focused on the animal's fleece. But it's meant it's a little pigeonholed with only one avenue for making money. Now, as it tries to diversify, alpaca meat is appearing on the menu at more local restaurants. Diners attending a special alpaca dinner in Melbourne recently sampled the animal from head to tail, with five dishes showcasing different cuts of alpaca. Kath McAloon met the Peruvian chef who's introducing Australians to a meat that's been part of his country's diet since Inca times.
My name is Alejandro Sarabia. I'm the head chef of Pastuso restaurant in ACDC Lane, Melbourne. It's a Peruvian restaurant with a slightly modern influence in the cuisine, but respecting the traditional techniques and also the flavors and the ingredients from Peru.
And what are you cooking tonight? What's on the menu here tonight?
Well, tonight we're actually very excited because it's a special night for us. It's an alpaca head-to-tail dinner. It's our first alpaca dinner here in Melbourne. We have alpaca in our regular menu, which is one of our best sellers. And that's why we decided to go forward and create this special night that showcase the different cuts of alpaca and a few other surprises as well.
Okay, so you say alpaca head to tail. What is on the menu tonight?
Well, we're going to start with alpaca brain ravioli, served with a quinoa broth, braised shiitake mushrooms, and some baby rocket on top. Then the next course is an alpaca neck terrine with cherries, sour cherries, microplane hazelnuts, red quinoa sprouts. Then we go through the third dish will be a 15-day dry-aged alpaca strip loin with parsnip puree, spring beans, and charred beetroots. Grilled alpaca cutlet with beer and coriander rice, Amazonian pickled chilies. And then the final alpaca dish will be a slow-cooked alpaca shoulder, which is our staple dish at the moment, served with cumin and carrot puree, served with Malbec jus. And to finish, we have a flourless chocolate sponge with two different textures, dark chocolate mousse, white chocolate mousse, and alpaca crisp.
But that doesn't involve alpaca meat.
That doesn't involve alpaca meat. I think that for the next one, we'll probably will try a little bit with alpaca blood in the chocolate, but we'll try. We'll see.
So it's obviously a very versatile meat. You've sort of reeled off five different dishes there that alpaca meat will be served in. What are some of the other characteristics of it?
It's one of the healthiest red meat in the market at the moment, very low percentage of cholesterol. It's also very lean and very easy to understand in terms of the flavor. It's the flavor, if we want to compare it to something, it will be between beef and lamb. This brings another perspective of a game animal. Usually game animals are very strong in flavor, very bloody. The alpaca, it's a little bit more light, more delicate, more refined to the taste. Doing this kind of dinners, our main goal is to present the meat and also to show that there's different ways to cook it, there are different textures in the different cuts that we can use the alpaca. There's no wastage on it, basically.
In Australia, I guess when we think of alpacas and we think of farming alpacas, you tend to think of their fibre. Is there much interest in eating the meat of alpacas in Australia?
I think that nowadays, because people are getting more health conscious as well on what they're eating, and also they are a bit more adventurous in trying new meats, the market is more open to eat alpaca as the meat.
What was the reaction when you first put alpaca on the menu at your Australian restaurants?
I was very excited. As a Peruvian, for me, having alpaca locally sourced and so well treated was great. It was a little bit difficult at the beginning to introduce it, but slowly while people have been tasting it and doing this kind of dinners and also being part of different showcasing alpaca in different festivals, brings them into the people, they will be like, yeah, well, I'll give it a go. And then they start trying it and they start talking about it. So it's pretty good.
Is it a popular meat in Peru?
Alpaca meat has been in the Peruvian diet since the Inca times. There was a bit of time between probably the 70s and the 80s where all these ingredients were lost in time and nobody was using it so much. But because Peruvian cuisine has been evolving and growing so much around the world and getting so much good chefs interested in Peruvian cuisine, all these ingredients has been rescued. So nowadays you can go to Peru and try alpaca in Cusco, which is the highlands, or you can go up try alpaca in Lima, which is the capital of Peru in the coast. So more chefs are trying alpaca putting it in the menu, so it's good.
What are you expecting the reaction to be tonight for people that have booked to come along to this meal? I guess what are you expecting the diners might be interested in, or what do you think the highlight of the dinner might be?
A lot of the people that are coming tonight are guests that has been to Pastuso previously. They have been having dinner here previously and they probably try alpaca. So tonight is going to be more like an adventure between starting from the brain, which I'm not going to tell them that it's brain until the end of the night, to see their reactions and to see, you know, their comments first. And also to understand that alpaca, it's another option of meat available as well. I think it will be opening the doors wider to the alpaca world. That's, I think, the main goal tonight.
Harvey Golan is the general manager of Illawarra Prime Alpaca on the New South Wales South Coast, who've provided the meat for this alpaca dinner.
I'm amazed at how many ways they serve alpaca, but I keep constantly seeing different ways that people do it. It's one of those meats that seems to lend itself to different flavours.
He says they're seeing more and more demand for alpaca meat from restaurants and retailers.
I think last year it was about 32 tonne we processed. It's increasing all the time. The year before that might have been 20 tonne. So it's growing, but we have to grow it at a sustainable rate. We've had export orders. We don't fill them. We don't want to fill them because we want to make sure Australia's right first.
Is the alpaca industry in Australia, is it still a fleece-based industry, or is meat becoming more part of the main game, I guess?
Well, it is a fleece-based industry, but what we say, there's fleece-based and there's genetic-based, so the selling of animals for their genetics, which Australia has some of the best genetics in the world now, and also the fleece. But we say there's a third leg. You can't have a stool with two legs, you need something else. And we've always said we need a third leg to the industry, and that's the meat industry. We can't have 15-year-old wethers running around a paddock eating our pasture without being productive. And at that stage, the fleece isn't there. You know, you're getting 50 cents a kilo when it costs you, you know, $10 to $15 to cut off the animal in the first place.
And that sort of time, once you've had a couple of fleeces off them, is that the prime? When's the prime eating time, I guess?
Yeah, we're finding between 18 months and 2 years is the perfect time. So they're fully grown. The meat comes into itself. It's not strong in flavour. It doesn't seem to get strong in flavour, doesn't matter how old they are, but it's when the meat is at its most tender and the animal has grown out properly. We actually have invested in a PhD study along with Riddick for a girl by the name of Mel Smith. She's doing her PhD at the moment. She's doing it on alpaca meat. So we're looking at all those things. And one of the things that have come out of her PhD is how great the meat ages. And by aging it between 21 days to 4 or 5 weeks, it brings on another flavour and another texture, which is just incredible.
We're seeing it well and truly on the menu here tonight with sort of 5 different dishes. Are you hoping it might become more of a staple on restaurants in Australia, sort of across the board of cuisines?
I do, I think it will. There's people taking it on. I mean, we've got a local hotel that we work with. We wanted to do an alpaca burger. We thought it would be a good idea. We work with him, we work with a meat scientist to get the recipe right. It's now 20% of his turnover is now alpaca burger. It's going great guns, and we keep on trying to use the meat and giving it to people like Alejandro and working with them to find new dishes. We do a double smoked leg, so we call it like an alpaca ham, so to speak, which is very, very lean. So the meat is coming out less than 5% fat, so it's leaner than any other protein basically on the market. Red meat by far. It's very low in cholesterol, but it's also very high in protein and iron, so it's a great meat all round.
What are you most looking forward to eating here tonight?
I just had a taste of the neck terrine, which is just sensational. I've had the brain ravioli in the past. That was sensational. But I think the age line for me is. But I hear what Alejandro does with his meat. I send it down in its raw form, and I hear what Alex brings out the other side of it, and so I can't wait to taste all of them.
Harvey Gollan of Illawarra Prime Alpacas speaking with Kath McAloon at a recent alpaca dinner in Melbourne. Not quite sure I could go the alpaca brain ravioli, but each to their own. It's not just alpaca farmers that are thinking outside the square when it comes to making money from growing food. A beef farm in England has taken the paddock-to-plate trend a step further. It's created a gift for the person who has everything – two of their best steaks, and a bottle of matched wine. The hardest part of the business was getting the packaging right, but now that that's been perfected, the business is growing. Laura Poole has the story.
It's a gift box with a difference. Gloucestershire cattle farmers Paul and Kirsty Westaway are packaging up their top cuts of Aberdeen Angus and mailing that meat to UK consumers.
A few years ago, we got started. We make great beef. We've won some awards with it. So we wanted to get a bit closer to the consumer. So we launched an online business called Your Perfect Night In, which is very much a gift business. So it's matching steaks to artisan wines, packaging them up nicely and giving them for a gift business. So if Uncle Harry wants a present, you can go online, order that, and we deliver it on an overnight courier service. It's been a really nice success, and it seems to work really, really well, and it's a business growing really fast.
The obvious question is mailing steak. How does that work? The Westaways have developed a special packaging technique to send out their beef.
Basically, we buy the primals backs. We buy strip loins or whole fillets or ribeyes. That gets butchered into double steak packs, vac packed, and then we send it out wrapped in biodegradable ice blocks, then wrapped in a wool blanket made from English wool, and it arrives at absolutely the perfect temperature. So if we send it frozen, it's still frozen when it arrives. If we send it chilled, it's still at the right temperature. So that was a big part of getting the business going, was getting that bit absolutely right, because, of course, the integrity of the beef is a really important part of the business.
And who's your market? Who's buying these gift packs?
It's a great big range age, but it's 99% gifts. So present for Uncle Harry, wedding presents, Christmas presents, lots of thank you presents. You know, thanks for putting us up for the weekend, here's something to do. So lots of things like that. Never ceases to amaze me how diverse our customer base is. I have the same challenge that we all have. My dad's 70 this year. He can only have so many pairs of socks, and therefore it's really nice if you give him a present. And my dad loves steak, he loves wine, and he loves the gifts.
And what's the price range? What does it cost to buy a couple of steaks and a bottle of wine and have it delivered to your house?
It goes from about, starts off, some of the more simple boxes would be £30 a box, up to £60-70 a box. But those, the more expensive boxes would have added gifts in there, so they'll have steak knives and salt and pepper and wine kits and all that sort of stuff, which is a really nice thing for somebody to keep after they've scoffed the wine and scoffed the steak.
Mm-hmm. And is it making money?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm trying not to waste too much of my children's inheritance as we go along. And it was a fairly low-cost business. The internet allows you to start these businesses relatively simply. We only buy the primals, so we haven't got too much of a carcass balancing issue. So, yeah, it's profitable already, and it's a business that we hope to franchise around the world when we get our foundations absolutely right here.
Paul Westaway started his Aberdeen Angus farm from scratch. He runs about 360 cows, with the online part of the business a small part of where the beef ends up. They've imported Australian Angus cattle genetics from southwest Victoria to help build up their herd.
I'm not into too much emotion. We'll very happily go where there's data. And certainly there's some very interesting things in Australia that we need to bring back here and use on our farms.
Cattle farmer Paul Westaway from southwest England. Now, still in the UK, where the organic sector has built up a barrier between itself and conventional farmers that needs to come down. At least that's the message from Patrick Holden. He's the former head of the UK's premier organic group, the Soil Association. Speaking on the Prince of Wales farm in Gloucestershire, Mr. Holden says His Royal Highness's organic property demonstrates the potential for more sustainable food production.
Well, we've been going round the Highgrove estate, Prince Charles's farm. And of course, he was one of the pioneers of sustainable agriculture. He started farming here in 1985. And now, around 30 years later, we can see the fruits of his vision and his leadership. I personally think he is a great man, and he had the courage to put his principles into practice on more than 1,000 acres here in Gloucestershire back in the 80s. He ran into some criticism. He was even ridiculed, but now more and more people are making a pilgrimage to this farm because they can see that what he's done is really important, because he's addressing the key challenge of our time, which is how we can farm and produce food more sustainably.
How would you describe the systems in place on this property?
Well, the key thing he's done is to avoid the use of nitrogen fertilizer and pesticides, and he's adopted rotational practices to build soil fertility. And through using those methods, growing clover and grass for maybe 3 or 4 years and then ploughing that up and growing a succession of grain crops or vegetables, he's building the biological fertility of the soil and producing healthy crops, and the yields are really remarkably good, considering that you can't ever produce the very high yields that you would do under highly intensive farming.
What are the lessons you think that can be learnt from this property?
I think that every farmer in the world is united and needs to be united around the need to build soil fertility, to recycle nutrients, to make the minimal use of non-renewable external inputs, to address climate change, to reduce pollution, and to improve public health. All those things connect the United Kingdom with Australia, and I believe that all farmers need to feel as if we are on a journey towards more sustainable management of our farming, and that's so exciting. This is an inclusive movement, whereas I think there has been a tendency, certainly in this country, for the conventional farming community to see the organic farming movement as something separate and to feel rather threatened by it.
That's the first time you've used that term, organic. I mean, there are associations with the term. Do you think we need to label properties?
Well, you know, I'm telling this against myself, because I was one of the pioneer organic producers back in the 70s. In fact, I even wrote the first draft of the organic dairy standards. But our well-intentioned project to create a market for the products from sustainable agriculture, because we could see that unless we got more for our products, we weren't going to stay in business, I think maybe need to be adjusted now in the face of these global sustainability challenges, and we need a more inclusive approach. Now, I'm not abandoning organic farming. I shall continue to farm organically, but I'm as interested in the issues, in fact, more interested in the issues than I am in the label. And I think we need to encourage all farmers to think about what's wrong with the present farming systems, not feel threatened by it, but actually think, well, how can we together each year make our farming systems more sustainable?
But does it make money? I mean, we're standing on the Prince's farm, and I mean, people might look at that from a sceptical point of view and go, well, is this actually making money, or is it being propped up?
Well, I can speak with authority here. At the moment, there is not as good a business case for farming this way as there is for farming intensively. And the Prince of Wales, when he started farming here back in the 80s, he said, look, you know, if anybody can afford to try it out, I can, and I should be doing that. It's my responsibility. So now, using this more true cost accounting approach, we need to create a situation, an economic climate, where there is a business case for rolling this out on a wider scale. That's the challenge.
Sustainable Food Trust Chief Executive Patrick Holden speaking with Laura Poole. I hope you've enjoyed the program this week and our travels around Australia and the world. Of course, you can find more information about the program and our news and features online. And you can also subscribe to a podcast if you'd like to at abc.net.au/rural. Thanks to technical producer Matthew Sigley. I'm Edwina Farley. Bye for now.